Hi, this is Patrick Kirst, and you're listening to the Sound Architect Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Sound Architect Podcast. I am your host, Sam Hughes, and as you just heard, I am joined by composer Patrick Kirst. Thanks for joining me today, Patrick. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, before we discuss your recent work on Kissing Booth 2, I would love to hear how your journey into music composition began.
Sure. I mean, I started actually writing music for theater plays at my local high school back in Germany. That was, you know, when I was 16 or 17, and I had so much fun just working with a director for the first time and seeing music as a part of a whole process where many art forms come together and like contributing to something and being in a team. And I think that launched this journey where I felt like, man, this is maybe something that I should be pursuing. And then I didn't for so long after I did this high school thing. I studied just music, but then it came more and more. It was more and more clear that I'm not the performer kind of person, that I'm really more of a writer and composer. And that crystallized, I guess, during my study years already in Germany, but then also abroad in the US.
Oh, nice. So where did you move over to the US, sorry?
Where or when? When it was in 2000, and I started actually in Boston at the famed Berklee College of Music, where I studied some jazz and also took some film music classes just to get a little taste of what this business is about.
Oh, amazing! So, when did you? What would you say was your kind of big break into film scoring, shall we say?
That started, you know. I would say I did a lot of like short films, you know, like back, you know, after I studied at, you know, at Berklee, I moved to New York, studied at New York University, and then studied this again.
That is a lot of studying.
Yes, a lot of studying, really. Like that's like 10, if I count all the years, I think it's 9 or 10 years. Like I had already like 6 years of conservatory training in Germany before I headed over to the States. And then another 3 years over there on all different locations. Now Boston, New York, and then LA. And then in LA, I actually really did this, you know, pretty famous, you know, certificate. It was back in the day, it was called the Certificate Program in Scoring for Motion Pictures at USC. Yeah. And then I really, you know, I planned on coming back to Germany after a year or two. And then, well, I guess I got stuck in LA and really I liked it. You know, I liked this, I was infected with this nice virus called filmmaking, not the corona, but this nice filmmaking virus, and I loved it. And then gradually, I would say 4 years after I graduated from USC, I got more and more gigs, the first independent features, and then probably a friend of mine. It was probably the first little break. He had some connections to Disney through his father.
Oh, wow.
And they were working on a re-edit, so to speak, a theatrical re-edit of the BBC Planet Earth series. And they turned that into Disney Nature's first nature documentary called Earth, based on that series.
Oh, wow.
And they needed George Fenton, original composer, and they used most of his music. And then they needed some additional music for certain specific areas. And I was fortunate enough to get a stab at one of the more funny scenes in that film, about these birds and these funny birds. And so that was my first little break with like, wow, this is my first real gig. I mean, I also at the same time, I started writing additional music and orchestrating for acclaimed composer Aaron Zickman. And he took me on his team, and I was, you know, became an integral part for like about 10 years that I worked for him in many different various capacities, from arranging to orchestrating to also writing additional music. And that actually these two things, I guess, these two events, I'd say, these were my first little mini breaks into this industry.
That's super awesome, though. So, like, after, what was it, nearly 10 years of training and studying, and then 10 years as well, like, working constantly, it must have been such a... I mean, every day is a school day, right? You're learning something all the time. Even after 20 years in the industry, you're learning things. But when was the crossover when you were like, okay, I'm not studying anymore, I'm doing? Like, when was that feeling where, you know, you study for so long because you want to have that knowledge, right? But then there's a point where you're like, no, I know what I'm doing now.
You never know what you're doing. We never know what we're doing.
Sorry, you look like you know what you're doing. That's the point, right? That's what we try and do.
Yes,
you
exactly.
look like you know what you're doing.
When did I start looking like I knew what I was doing? Okay, that's a great question, actually. I'd say, perhaps maybe about 10 years ago, maybe, like 8 to 10 years ago, like really the first couple years, you know, starting to write some music for Aaron Zickman or orchestrating for Aaron Zickman and then having my own projects, that was 2007. And then probably another 3-4 years of, you know, like just getting better at this craft. You know, I felt at that time I was still learning so much, also not only from Aaron Zickman, all other directors, and I still did a lot of short films and a lot of unpaid work, and all of a sudden more and more projects came along, and I guess I got also better at, you know, at this craft. And it's a very specific craft.
Yeah.
Music meets film, right? That's something we can all write. Many, you know, composers and musicians, they can all write some music, but once you're putting this together to film, there's so much to learn about the craft and the art of filmmaking and becoming more of this kind of a filmmaker in the process and less of a musician, of someone that plays an instrument or like that composes music for its own sake, just to understand the directors better and understand where they're coming from and understand actually how they're editing picture together with the editor, all these little details of storytelling. And this is really, that's a really complex art form where music and media meets. And I guess this took me after school, at least I would say 7-8 years. So like it's a good 8 years or maybe 8-9 years where I'm feeling now more and more comfortable. I felt more and more comfortable what I was doing. And today, yes, I can probably pretend that I know what I'm doing.
Because one of the key things, right, and I had this in freelance sound design as well. When you first start, because I assume you started out freelancing at some point, right? You just kind of went freelance.
Yes.
To become a freelance composer. And that moment is very, very scary, because then you're suddenly defining your own worth, right? You're the one going out there going, I do this. This is how much I charge because I deserve this much money because I'm good enough to do that.
So true.
And then
so
you start off and you're like, okay, so how much am I worth? And how much do I deserve to be paid? And how do you decide, A, when to like take the leap and be like, right, okay, I'm ready to go solo. I am ready to do this. And then how do you even... you know, choose what people should be paying you, or how do you gain that confidence where people are like, I'm not paying you that, and you don't go, oh yeah, that's fair, it's quite a lot.
Right. I think you don't really decide that you're all of a sudden on your own and you're doing this. I think this path is somehow you're just walking the walk, as I always like to say, like you're walking the path to and you see where it's, you know, where you're headed, and you just follow certain projects, and all of a sudden things start to happen. You can't really plan on that, and I think you don't really also know exactly what's happening, you know, where you're at right now. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or if there's another call coming in. These things are like so uncertain, and careers and also I feel like are so they're so personal. You cannot project somebody else's career or somebody else's path on your own path. That's not going to happen. And so, but to understand more and more, you know, it's all about gaining more confidence. And we as artists maybe are probably this kind of breed that always, you know, is seeking perfection or seeking something extra cool. And so we probably always feel like we are never ready for anything.
Yeah.
And that at some point though, you have to make that gradual switch to also becoming a business and to be your own business, your own entrepreneur, and your own, you have to feel this out. All of a sudden, maybe you get another call and another call. Maybe at some point you're busy, so busy that you would have to actually really also charge something that you feel is worth your time.
Yeah.
And I think that is a gradual shift. I wouldn't say that's at that point in time, that's when this started. It's a very gradual and natural process of gaining more and more confidence, knowing more and more what you're doing, what you can contribute to someone's project. And I think this price point, this has always been a problem for me. But at some point, I just realized that at a certain, let's say, market position that you're in, I'm in the middle class of those kind of composers. I'm not Hans Zimmer or John Williams, I'm not there at that point, maybe level yet. But in the meantime, I'm in a certain bracket of composers, and there's a lot of my colleagues, and there's certain price points that are just normal to charge. That's just there's no secret sauce or secret science behind this formula. It's actually very much based on the budgets of the films, the projects that you then it's almost formulaic, where you already know in what kind of bracket of budgets you will be. So it's not so much of, you can probably negotiate, and with the help of an agent, maybe negotiate maybe 10% more, 20% more, but it's not such a rocket science where you have to figure this out. And it's, I think, in this kind of bracket of composing, the fees are within also a very set bracket. And it's something to learn. And so, like, for now, if someone approaches me, I can, if I know a little bit more about the project, I can actually very accurately predict what their budget's going to be. And I think that also comes with just experience. You just do more and more of this, and then and more you just know where the sweet spot is that you can actually charge, and that's. But again, it's not something where, let's say, you're getting $1 million in creative fees. That's a John Williams type of a fee, right? Or even $2 million or whatever. And that's in the upper stratospheres here, right?
So
for us, like normal the top 5% composers, exactly, or even less.
Yeah, 1% even.
I would say even less than that. I'm like, because that would be 1 in 100 gets more than $1 million.
That's true. It's like 0.0001%.
Exactly. And most of us, in the normal human beings kind of a world,
mere mortals.
The mortals. I always feel like all these other guys, they're just living on another planet or something.
Like Mount Olympus over in the corner. Yeah.
Exactly. And so for us normal guys, they're very down to earth. It's a very down to earth calculation of fee.
Yeah.
But also, I have to say, as a European specifically going to the States, that process of actually charging anything for your work is quite a process, it's something to understand that this is a business, that it is the entertainment business. This is a project that is also made to make profit.
Yeah.
And so you have to just learn that when you're contributing, when you're called to add your vision and your artistry, but your craft, that is just also to make this project even more successful, and also in monetary terms, also more successful. No producer wants to make films and always lose money on their films. So you're there also to make this a positive, successful business. And that's why you have to learn also to just charge things that feel in relation to the overall budget seems fair.
Yeah.
And that's that is a process, but as a European, you have to learn that. I think more so because in the European world, very often, you just help each other out. That's kind of the mindset.
Yeah.
You're helping a guy out. I'll write you the score for free. Yeah, you can do whatever. If I ever have to shoot a film, you can edit it for me for free or something like that. And as much as I love that too, that mentality, very much in Europe, this kind of, you're part of this kind of community and you're all in the same pool and you're all helping each other out. I love that. But, you know, you also have to make a living and you have to, and you have to make that switch to actually to a successful business, you know, your own business. You have to make that step to become an entrepreneur, to not only just be enclosed in your own little composing bubble and composing shed. You have to reach out and really market yourself as a business. And that's always this fine line. You are the artist, but the artist also is an entrepreneur nowadays.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me, the process in general, like all of it. The moment, so, you know, when you first start out, and especially in an industry where your kind of profession was born from passion.
Right.
Then it's difficult when you enjoy what you do and you love what you do and you're pursuing it because you like it. In the beginning, you're just grateful to be able to do it. And then you're grateful that you're getting any money for it.
So
and then
true.
You get to the point where you're like, actually, this is not enough. That's a bit silly because I've been doing this for this long, or I can do this, I can do that. I know I'm good now. You know, at least I know I'm worth more than this. And it's interesting how that evolves. Like, I find it super fascinating. And the flexibility. So, and you don't have to say whether you do this or not at all. But I remember a friend of mine back in the day was saying how he was coming up with rates, because everyone talks about rates as if there's a definite number. And he was like, well, it depends on the budget, obviously, but it also depends how much I want to do it. If I don't want to do it, I tend to mark up the price quite a bit, and then if they pay it, mm-hmm. then I'll do it.
sure. That's good also. But usually, if I really don't want to do it, I'm at that point also in my career where I don't want to waste time.
Just don't do it, right?
No, then I rather study or do some other things.
Yeah.
If I feel that this is really helping someone else, and the project is maybe more of a, let's say, a beginner's kind of project, or a beginning filmmaker comes to me and I feel, you know, I don't want to sound arrogant right now, but I just want to, maybe what I would then in those cases usually do is I would rather recommend students, you know, my own students, to do, you know, those kind of jobs that I feel that I'm, you know, I don't want to, this sounds so weird to say you're above that, but you're,
I know what you're trying to say. Yeah.
I'm not a beginner anymore at this craft. And so for me, it's not about practicing or exercising anything anymore. You know, I don't need that kind of a practice or exercise. A student might need that, and a beginning filmmaker also is still practicing, right, the craft.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why it makes more sense to bring together those two, you know, together, that are both still finessing their craft, rather than for me, for example, to come in and take on a project where I feel like I'm almost like I'm dominating the project because I'm, you know, quite more experienced in the art of filmmaking than, because I've been like I'm in my later 40s now. So like I've been doing this now for what, 15 years now, like seriously, probably. And so that's just comes with experience, that you probably also attract the projects that are probably right for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and sometimes if you don't want to do the jobs, you know, for these same reasons, sure, you could just be mean and just, you know, hijack the price up. It's a funny way of thinking of why not? I mean, like if it works for that person, everyone's happy in the end. Sure, great. You know, I'm all for that.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the crux of it, really. That you've got to. Where you have that point where it's no longer about what you can give them. It's also about, okay, well, what am I gaining from this project by putting this extra effort in that I don't really want to do? You know, it's when you get to that point in your career where you can pick and choose, right? Because the freelance mentality is like, okay, I just need to keep work coming in. I need work constantly. So you do make compromises here and there if you don't have enough work on, for example. But when you get to that stage where you're like, actually, no, I'm just not going to do that. And the first time you say no to a project is huge.
It's a good feeling. It's liberating, because that means, okay, you have achieved something, you know, in your path, in your career path. And that's great. I also feel like at some point, It's like a, you know, like it's an automatic mechanism, like where you at some point accumulate so many credits and perhaps also bigger and, you know, better credits that you don't even get the call anymore to do these kind of, you know, projects from filmmakers that are still, let's say, experimenting,
yeah,
or like beginners. And that's, and again, I sometimes do actually write a score for someone that, you know, is producing their first feature film. I sometimes, or first short film. Of course I do, because when I see something very special in that person, I feel like there's something very special there that I feel that this filmmaker is going somewhere, and it's it will be a fun ride and I think a very good match. If I feel that, it doesn't really matter, even if it's not a fully polished project, but I can feel that there's something special there. Obviously, you want to attach yourself and you want to team up with someone, especially when the chemistry is great. So then there's always exceptions, you know, to that.
Of course, yeah. And everything's flexible, right?
Absolutely. It's interesting when the whole flow of projects and how you get what and what follows what. It's interesting. I think the more you're doing it, and again, you're getting better and better projects, and it's a natural thing, you know. And,
yeah.
But there's a critical mass, so to speak, that you have to accumulate. That critical mass you have to get, and at some point, there's an automatic thing that happens, and you're
like
in
a
that
shift, right?
It's like a shift. It's an automatic flow all of a sudden. And I'm not saying that, you know, like it's so automatic that you will be busy forever. So no, you will probably have some dips. Everyone has some certain maybe little timeouts and shifts and turns, sometimes busier times and not so busy times. But this critical mass, I think, is also quite important. You have worked on this big film, you have worked on this, you have contributed to this one, you have even maybe scored this one. All of a sudden, you know, you gain more and more visibility to let's say agents or other filmmakers and producers, and they see, oh wow, this person is actually is putting out a lot of work and maybe also prestigious work, and that makes you more and more attractive as an artist. So like it's a path again. You become more and more attractive, I think, as you go, because you're more experienced at the craft. You know more now where you are also as an artist, what your voice is, and it seems that this also gets heard by your employers. They understand that perhaps your voice comes out more and more, and you become more and more special also in what you do and how you tell a story. That's also a process, I have to say, artistically. What happens in 10 years, for example, in an artist's career is remarkable, because you uncover yourself, you discover yourself more and more, and you develop this taste, what you like and what you do not like. And again, that makes you, I think, more and more attractive, because this voice is something, you know, people nowadays look for the different voice, the different approaches, the interesting approaches, the interesting sonic footprints, sonic identities that you can bring to the project that are very unique to you as an artist. And that's what people look for, I think. The traditional and the generic, and, you know, like that's something that, you know, when artists start out, I think, or composers start out, you know, I myself included, you probably cling on to other composers' chord progressions and sounds and things, and you're trying to do more of like something like style copies, you know?
Yeah.
So you're getting too close in imitation. And the more you're doing this, the more you realize, the more you distance yourself from these artists that you admire. You still admire them, you know. I can say I still admire Alexandre Desplat, and I still admire John Williams and Hans Zimmer, and, you know, but, you know, like at some point it's also a natural uncovering and discovering yourself as an artist. Your voice shines more and more, and also I think that makes you also more and more attractive in this highly convoluted jungle of composers. Don't you agree? I mean, like, it's such a jungle.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it really is a jungle out there. And that's why I feel for these kind of like new aspiring composers or kind of students who they want these hard and fast answers. And, I go to multiple events and I see all the same question all the time. You know, it's always like, how do I decide what my rate is? How do I, do this? Should I find a niche? Should I do that? And a lot of these questions that they ask, you can see them almost not frustrated, but mildly confused, because there's always a different answer. And technically, there is no answer.
Right.
Because you will find your own path. And then obviously they're like, oh, and you're like, well, I'm sorry, that's just kind of how it is. Like,
yes.
Just keep doing it. That's all we can advise you. Just keep doing it.
it's that. And it's frustrating, I think, also in this, exactly as you mentioned. I think there is something, because students, I feel that students achieve musical things like musical technique much faster than my generation.
Oh, definitely. I think it's the same across the board.
Yeah, exactly. And so I had to go to the library and check out books and read at the library and check out scores and read them at the library and listen. It's a very slow process, right?
Yeah.
Like, and if you really wanted to check something out, look at we can't imagine. It's very hard to imagine a world without the internet.
It's crazy, right? Before YouTube,
it's so
before
crazy.
Google, before anything.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't
like
just
Google.
Look for a song.
Exactly. Or like YouTube and just play it. Or like cross-reference and compare quickly.
Like AB, two different YouTube videos instantly. Like
different interpretations of a classical piece of work. Or like whatever, a 60s song. Or like it's an incredible tool. That it's an accelerator in terms of just knowledge, like knowing certain artists and knowing like it's a very wide knowledge, as we always say, right? It's not such a deep knowledge, but at least it's a wide knowledge, and that can also help you, for example, this film music thing, just to figure this out, because you can now research everything in film music so easy, and you can just pick and choose and here copy this a little bit, copy this a little bit, and you get to an incredible proficiency in just the craft and technique, what you need to know, certain, let's say, chord progressions or sound manipulations. There's all these tutorials, everything is there, so you have all that stuff already there.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at I think, this proficiency, is achieved at an earlier and earlier age. And I, for me, for example, where I was when I was 29, my students usually are already at that level when they're 22 or something. Or
20.
It's at least a 7 or 8 year, difference. And that also can cause frustration, because now you're what? You're graduating, you're 24 or 25. I graduated when I was 30, something around 30. Let's say they graduate when they are 24 or 25, when they leave our program at USC.
Yeah.
And then, since they already know so much, there comes this, I would say, it sounds a bit harsh, but this expectation to also then, because they feel they're ready to get this gig, that will just follow and fall on their lap. That causes frustration and impatience, I feel. And you mentioned that already, this impatience, like, hey, I already know what I'm doing. I've learned the craft. I am there. I'm really ahead of the game. And now where are my gigs? And that can cause frustration in this really younger generation. And they have to, as you say, walk the walk, walk the path, just walk it, just see, and just give yourself, allow yourself time. And when you're 24 and you've graduated, you have all that knowledge. Man, I envy you.
Yeah,
me
too.
It's amazing. I envy you. You have now all the time in the world to study a little deeper this and that and meet some people you have with all this knowledge. Oh my God, it's crazy. It's that's a wonderful thing. But they have to deepen that knowledge. Also, look for these musical deeper values in music and find that. and discover their voice more and more. But that is not, you can't take a shortcut to discover your voice, in my opinion. That just takes time of experimentation, developing taste. That's something to be more far-sighted and looking ahead and having this vision about where you will be in 10 years, or like this, just to feel this out more and just allow yourself this time to develop yourself. And it's amazing how much time advantage you have. Take this advantage and relax, you know? So, but I think very often it's the opposite, because, you know, social media is such a fast-paced world.
Oh, yeah.
With all these little posts.
So much pressure.
So much pressure. And I need to post something to feel good about myself and to have other people see what I'm up to. And this comparing
and stay relevant
careers.
And popular.
Yes,
and
exactly. Yeah, and comparing careers, looking left and looking right. Oh, this person's ahead. Oh, this person scored this film. Oh, I better score now this next one. Where is it? So this creates unrest.
Yeah.
It creates impatience, frustration, and so you can fall easily into this hole. I've seen it many times happen, and so groups are great also, I think, but also groups of struggling composers sometimes can also hinder you to, because I always would want them to have that fire and be competitive and not dwell into that group of, oh, we're all in this together, nothing's happening for us. And,
yeah.
You know, like, just see it from the other side. See it, we are so young. We have it all in front of us. We are so talented. And we can make this happen. And you know, like, and just see. And I see that sometimes at USC, you know, where our groups, you know, our students form these groups and meet. Especially this year as a group, it's kind of wonderful to see where they all help each other, and they just, you know, one person gets a gig and then employs all the other students from the class to just help them out to get this gig done. And that's a good use of talents, you know, like, I feel it's a great opportunity of this next generation that is so young and so ready, so early, to then just, you know, meditate and take a breather and just, you know, unfold your voice over the next 10 years.
But it's almost a cliche, but it's the same kind of deal with everything, right? It's the benefit of hindsight and experience.
Yes.
So people always look at the young and at their position and go, oh my God, you have so much opportunity. You should be making the most of it. And the young are always like, but I want to go out and do things now. Like, I just want to go and do stuff.
But you don't, yeah, you don't, exactly. You don't see the forest. You see the single tree right now in front of you. You don't see where things, you know, like Steve Jobs, I think, said that this hindsight was very important for him, because he didn't know, you know, when he was just interested in crafting, or like the graphics of the fonts that we now use, you know, these graphical fonts, that he was very much into design. And he didn't know at the time what that really meant, you know, in his career later on. But now in hindsight, he knew that this is, you know, this connecting these dots, you know, I'm always like reminded of what he said there. And that's very important. Like for me, the theater world back when I was at high school, that was a very important dot, you know, in my little history here, my career history. And I feel, you know, like this, what you're doing right now, you don't know where that leads to in 5 years, 3 years, 10 years. You don't know that. So just follow the path. Follow, if you get an opportunity, take the opportunity. That's and something will happen. You know, like there's always something that happens. That's the cool thing also about this business.
Yeah.
So fun stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm going to get off my soapbox now about how lucky the youth are.
And, oh, yes.
And discuss with you about Kissing Booth 2. So how did it feel to return to the sequel after scoring the first Kissing Booth?
That felt, it felt good. You know, when you're doing a sequel, there's one good thing. That means you have already established the sound or the sound of the show. That's always like a little tricky in the beginning. The challenge, of course, is can you maintain that level? Can you develop the music in such a way that's meaningful, that takes these characters, you know, like, and you know, they have their own you know, progression they go through, coming of age, and there's a certain maturing process in the characters. And so that's the challenge, you know, when you come in to do a sequel. Now I want to mature that music also. The first one was, you know, also a huge success. That's the other pressure, of course. We want to make the second one as, hopefully, as successful as that first one.
Of course.
And that's the pressure. And you've already established the characters. Now you have to come up with some other little tricks, so to speak, or like develop that story musically. And so it's fun and it's challenging, as many of these are. Romantic comedies are always, for me at least, and I guess for many colleagues also, the hardest genre to write in, because it's not so high conceptually driven, because these are all very lower, these are lower concept kind of movies, where it's all about character development and story. It's all the dial. It's very dialogue heavy, and it's not so cinematic like an Out of Africa movie or like, you know, an Interstellar movie, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very different challenge. I mean, like, you know, I don't want to underplay what Hans Zimmer is doing for Interstellar or something. That's genius. But that's a different challenge. I just feel that comedy, the comedy genre, doesn't allow for so much creative leeway. I feel it's very much craft, and you have to feel, you know, the creativity in the detail, in my opinion. It's a very, you know, you're zooming into a certain detail, and there you can expand your creativity.
Well, in my mind, it's similar. So let me finish before you kind of question this. But in my mind, it's similar to horror, right? Where the music is also a tool.
Right.
Like it's there to enhance the experience and also be a part of the comedy or be a part of the horror. You know, I mean, yeah, you can claim that music is part of the action and part of everything else, but I feel like comedy and horror utilize that more.
Yes. Horror, though, I'm like, if I compare these two, there's an extreme difference. You know, horror, yes, there is a certain tool, as you said, you know, the whole thing is a tool of angst, of tension. And in comedy, we have this tool in the music. The music is the tool to make things more fun.
Of course.
And these are very, I don't want to say stereotypical, but these are very, these are devices that we use, you know, like in, you're saying pretty much there's a certain formulaic device that you use also in horror. You know, if you're doing these clusters or these sound design kind of things, you know how to achieve tension. And we, in the comedy, we know how to make things more funny and fun.
Like for want of a cheesy phrase, it's kind of like, you know, the music in comedy is in on the joke with you, you know, like they're in on
it.
And that's how it feels.
Yes, exactly. And pretty much for comedy, I've always feel like that I am in the room with the actors. I'm always there.
Yes.
Like when I'm scoring something so up close, you know, there's scenes always also in the kissing booth that are a little more removed from the scene. I'm always calling this zooming out a bit. You know, the musical lens is like a zoom lens. I can decide how close I want to be to the action and how far away I want to give more like of like a an arc, like where I'm just zooming out and just doing a more broader commentary.
Yeah.
So like these two things. But very often in the more slapsticky kind of scenes, you want to make sure that you're heightening also the physical energy on screen. You're heightening the slapstick fun, you know, like the little eyebrows, the little, you know, that you know, like the little slapstick things that go wrong, the embarrassing odd situations. These things and these are very hard challenges to actually timing and craft, and exactly every little note that you write now has something very, is saying something very, very specific. And so it's a very, finding this very reduced thing that says everything it needs to say without any dead weight that doesn't need to be there. That's also, I think, in comedy, it's very, very fascinating. I'm going from this chord to that chord, and all of a sudden it's a very different meaning at that point, you know, and that also makes it very hard and very crafty. I feel like comedies are very, it's a very craft heavy genre to be in.
Yeah.
Horror, to me, is also craft. Also, so a lot of craft. I mean, everything is a lot of craft. But there, at least, when you have to do tension, and this is all usually horror is about, either if it's very graphic or very cult, when it's going in this route, there's certain things that you have a little bit, in my opinion, a little more leeway. How do you do the darkness? How do you show the darkness? I can do this with just one piano, and play everything inside the piano and giving you all these clusters and things. It's pretty fast playing all the notes on the keyboard at once.
Yeah.
I can pretty fast, very fast, I can give you tension. Or something horrific, graphically horrific. And I feel in comedy, everything is a little bit more delicate. It's all these little elements, should I play this with a cello pizzicato, or maybe an electric cello pizzicato, or a harp pitz that is, muted. These are all tiny, tiny shifts in the timbre, but they make a dramatic, dramaturgical difference. And that, to me, to find that is a challenge. That's why I'm admiring these big comedy writers in LA, in Hollywood, so much. It's like, man, you're doing a great job. This is very hard. This is really hard. So I'm struggling a lot with that.
Yeah, well, it's so nuanced, right?
There's exactly
so many different facets of it that you can kind of tailor it towards, that of course it's kind of almost, mind-blowing the amount of choices you have.
So true. It's mind-blowing, but it's also at the same time, on the one hand, you have all these choices, but on the other hand, in comedy, you can't use them all.
Yeah.
You can't. It's so limiting, and I always very much feel like that my hands are so tied that I cannot give you this fully fleshed chord or this, because it would be too overbearing. It would, overweigh the picture, and it brings it out of balance. All of a sudden I'm concentrating, focusing on the music too much. You can't. You're supporting this funny action.
Yeah, of course.
This is always like, oh my God, now I'm saying too much and we're leaving out again. And now we're leaving out too much. Now nothing's left. No,
yeah.
We have to, it's like, oh gosh. So it's all the rhythm is not right. You know what? The groove is not quite right. I think this needs to be a little bit more syncopated here to give it this little more fun thing, or like a little more Latin flavored, or a little bit more, depending on where this thing plays, a little more of this, location sound, if the place, if a jazz idiom is wanted, for example, Sex and the City, I was fortunate to also work a little bit on Sex and the City, the movies. That's of course,
wow.
New York,
yeah.
New York and jazz, and Latin jazz, that's pretty much what now is, these are the things that made it also into the score, and Zygmunt did, and I think a fantastic job with these two movies to give you that and still be a little different from the actual show, the TV show.
Sex, yeah, of course, it's got to have that different feel.
Very, very. And the second one, I think, takes place in Abu Dhabi. And so you have all these Middle Eastern percussion instruments now, these flavors, and then still do the comedy right. I find this is, again, it's a tall order for any composer. And that's why I'm respecting these guys a lot.
Yeah, and I have the utmost respect, not only for composers in general, but like you say, especially the ones such as yourself who can find the nuances in comedy and kind of apply the right support to it.
It's a very has been a learning curve for me. Also, again, being European, I come more from this, probably, I guess, Beethoven era, right? Like Beethoven,
kind of
era,
a more like classical era, I guess.
Classical era. I grew up with, listening to Mozart, Beethoven, then of course, later on, Brahms, Mahler, Bartok, Stravinsky, Prokofiev. These are great influences in my world. So we are used also and tend a little bit to be more classical. And what that means, it's a bit more dramatic, I want to say, or melodramatic, we come from this music drama of opera and this, if you study this a lot and it you develop and you understand that language. Now in America, in the US, in most of these comedies, you know, like they have a certain Americana sound also, or like this, or I would say at least you could say it's a popish, more of a pop kind of a sound.
Yeah, definitely.
Based, you know, you just take this pop music and these chords, and to learn that language for someone that is classically European, like European classically trained like me, that has been a big challenge. That took me years to really understand what that is, like this Copland, for example, these chords, these harmonies that John Williams also uses a lot. You know, you feel like, oh man, what is that? And we don't use it as much because it's, you know, it's more open sounding.
Yeah,
it has an open, wider sound, and it's less, you know, like in musical terms, you speak of these cadences. You know, like things that gravitate towards earth, and so that's a little bit less defined and more open, and that makes it maybe also the ideal companion in comedy, where you don't want anything to be melodramatic.
Yeah,
you know, or you want this to be fun, so you borrow from all these other influence, but Americana sound, but also pop, rock world, Latin rhythm. Is all of that stuff makes that comedy genre. It's vibrant. It's very vibrant.
Yeah, and you have to have done something right, because congratulations, by the way, on the nomination for the People's Choice, was it the E Awards, the E People's Choice Awards, Comedy Movie of 2020, and you're up against Bill and Ted. I mean, how crazy does that feel? Like
it's unbelievable. I am really so happy that this happened, because, you know, we don't have a best comedy category, you know, at the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
I think we used to have that, but it's no longer there. So pretty much it's all drama films. And so like, where can, you know, a comedy also get heard and get, you know, get recognized, because we know our blood, sweat, and tears went into this film. Really, everyone, we worked so hard and put all our labor of love into telling this story, and I think the People's Choice Awards is that's an award, you know, but from the people, you know, and it's voted on by the people.
Yeah,
and
that's, exactly.
That if so, nowadays I feel that the people have a lot to say, because they're the audience, and they're deciding if a film is good or not good. It's not like a handful of critics anymore that decide on the fate of a film. It's really like, you know, Kissing Booth 1 was maybe not as favorable to the critics, but it was one of the most watched movies. It was one of the most popular movies, the most rewatched movie on Netflix. So like, wait a minute. So we are doing something right here. And there's this disparity happening that the people have become so important in deciding what is popular, what is good. And I feel that's a great award, you know, like, and I hope we can even, maybe you have a chance of winning even. That would be fantastic, because I know, you know, Netflix released the numbers that for Kissing Booth, when Kissing Booth 2 came out, during the first 4 weeks, I think 66 million people watched that film.
Wow.
And that is a very, very high number. And that, again, shows if all these people voted, maybe that's also why we got the nomination. If they all vote also, maybe, you know, we have probably a good chance even of maybe just at least it's going to be close, probably.
Yeah, definitely. Well, at time of recording, it's the 7th of November, so it's not long. It's the 15th,
nope.
I believe.
Yep.
So, you know, just
very nervous
a week.
Here. I'm very nervous. Stuff. Yes. And Joey King, the main lead, is also actually nominated for Best Comedy Actress.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's
because
that's
of
awesome.
The Kissing Booth. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool.
That's super cool. So when you came back to the sequel, then What is it like from the director, like in terms of like saying about the music? Was he like, oh, pretty much just do what you did before, it was awesome? Or was he like, okay, this is the new direction of the sequel, you know, this is where we want to go musically? You know, how much freedom did you have over how to kind of own the score?
You know, as you might know, that we, you know, the editors work with temp scores.
Yeah.
The music editor also suggests temp scores. Mm-hmm. The director suggests temp scores. So before I even get to see it, I usually get to see it when it's already full of temp score.
Right. Like
luckily, on the second one, I think half of it, or like 40%, was pretty much tempted with Kissing Booth 1 music. And then the other 60% was like, you know, scores from all different other movies.
Yeah.
Rom-coms. And so since the editor already works with that and it gets screened already to a test audience. So, and it, you know, I think Kissing Booth 2 did remarkably well. Also, in terms of music, like the score sheets that we got back and all that, that was all really, really strong. And so for a composer then to say, you know what? No, I think you're all wrong. I think this should be all different now. We should go into a completely different direction. that usually does not happen. So we you know, I think my job is take the temp, get the feel from the temp. There's obviously something there that is, because they, you know, you have no idea. To get to the temp in the end, to get this also, it needs to be liked by the director. He cannot hate this temp because it would hurt this whole experience to work on the film. If you're always bothered by the temp, that's not gonna, it's not very, you know, constructive. So they go, you know, they do a lot of whatever this process is, you know, and Vince Marcello, you know, awesome director, he is very specific and knows exactly what he wants, but he works with the music editor almost the same way as he would work with me. He said very often he has to do the same work 3 times. He has to do it with the music editor first, then he has to do it with me, and then he has to do it with the sound editor.
Oh yeah, of course.
So to do the whole thing, because everything gets rebalanced in the actual dub stage, you know, like all the levels, for example, this stuff needs to be done again. Like you have to, whatever you've done with the natural sounds, you know, the boom mic that recorded that sound, everything's going to be replaced. Most of it, or 80%, probably gets replaced. ADR gets put in, new Foley comes in. This is all like all of a sudden, you're almost starting from scratch again to create that same magic again that we had when we were working with the less perfect, you know, sound, because there was a, you know, that was maybe a beach scene where you heard all these waves, the breaking waves, and or like there's a train or a plane, whatever, you still hear that on the boom mics when I'm working on that. It's not great, the sound is sometimes not great, but we are massaging the volumes and it's exactly the fades we want, and it's like everything is so perfectly like balanced, and that balance has to be recreated, and the same thing with the temp score.
Yeah,
you know, and me going through almost similar iterations to get to the point where we try everything else, and then probably go close to the temp again in the end, because that's how it is. You know, like you try and try and try and fail and you fail and you fail. I think on average, I have to do probably 5 to 6 rewrites, which I did. I did way more rewrites on the Kissing Booth 1 because we didn't know the sound at the time.
Yeah, of course.
Now we knew it, but still, again, as I said, comedy, hard genre. The director is almost sleeping on my couch. You know, like it's really like very hard work and trying out. No, not working. Different rhythm. Look at the temp again. Can I hear the temp again? Can I hear the temp again? It's like, oh gosh, okay. There's this piano note that kicks in right after that line when she says da 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 da, and that lick does exactly that emotion that I need right there. It's like, oh my god. Okay, so I have to then in some cases, you know, just rephrase the temp also. It can be that close. Sometimes you can go and deviate more.
Yeah.
But it's such a work of detail, and you have to love the details.
Yes.
And then you have to be a perfectionist. I think Vince, you know, he's a perfectionist. I certainly also am. I'm obsessed with detail. Maybe that's why it works. You know, it gets frustrating very, very, like, on every project.
Yeah.
But then we forgive each other.
Of course.
it's like, okay, we went through this. Okay, let's do it again. We went through this. Ah, let's do it again. And it's funny that way. But we also know, he knows that he can count on me, that even after the 10th version in Kissing Booth 1, we had sometimes 20 versions. Really, 20.
Oh, wow.
On the very opening of Kissing Booth 1, I think I had 40, because it's a 5-minute sequence, a very complicated thing. I think I had 40 different logic sessions that were like, not all of them were complete rewrites, obviously, but no, we need to shift this by 3 frames, 2 frames, 1 frame back. Like, really, like these kind of, these details.
Those are really like, detailed. Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Like editors, they take out 1 frame or they add 1 frame.
Yeah, true.
They do that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, okay, then if they are doing that, then I guess I have no excuse here. So sure. It needs to be 0.003 BPM faster now. Okay, to be over there, maybe a frame earlier or later. So it's
that is the nitty gritty. That is the details of the details.
exactly right. The magnifying glass of the magnifying glass.
Exactly.
It's fascinating though. I mean, like I like it enough also to, and I like. What I like most is to work with someone like Vince. Again, big shout out, Vince Marcello, incredible. Visionary also, and a great storyteller. He would always say to me, what's correct for the film? He would not say, what do I like best?
Yeah. Well, it's about the vision, right?
Exactly. What is needed here to make this film more successful, more entertaining, or what does the film need? What does the character need right here?
Yeah.
It's not specifically what the director likes to hear musically.
No, and that's what makes a good director. It's not about what he likes, it's about what the project needs.
Exactly right. And that's why I like it a lot. We have been working now, we met at USC, and I was a student in 2003 or 4, that's when we met. And then yeah, now we are like 16 years later. And the funny part is, when we first did Kissing Booth 1, we also, the sound editor and assistant sound editor, like re-recording engineer, we all met at USC.
That's awesome.
You know, we did short films together. Vince did his thesis film at USC, and Joe Zubern, big shout out, and Gabe Serrano, like they did the sound and sound editing for these things. I did the score. And then
that's so cool though.
Then we didn't work for like probably 10 years, like all of us together. And now with Kissing Booth for the first time, we were all again, like 14 years later or so.
That's crazy.
We met all again at the dub stage. It's like, hey guys, it's been a while.
How's it been?
That's funny to me. And that's also great about this business, right? You build a team, you know?
Yeah, the industry is so small as well, really, when you get into it. It's crazy.
It is. And it's fun this way. I love it. I mean, like, I really do. I like that part a lot, this collaboration.
Yeah, definitely.
To say, hey, Joe, and like the sound re-recording engineer, like, what do you think? Is the music a little too loud here? Should it dip and then be even stronger over there? Or like, da-da-da. Like, we finesse these things at the dub stage. Even more, bring it, give it more life. There's a lot. It's also, these kind of mixes are like insane, really.
Yeah.
You have no idea how many elements of backgrounds, of like these loops, background loops, then all this ADR, and then the dialogue sometimes has too many S's in there. They have to be DS'd, or then they have to be placed correctly. You know, like sometimes these subjective bubbles happen, right? Where the...
Yeah, of course.
Like what's in the mind of that actor. So like everything gets soft and silent around that actor. And then only the music and the actors there. Like there's a lot of artistic things that can be decided.
Yeah, it's amazing we ever make movies in the end, isn't it? Really, when you think of all the factors that need to come together.
It's fascinating. I think it's beautiful. I mean, like, it's, again, it's, to me, that's why I still love the art of filmmaking and the art of
It's incredibly impressive.
Film music also. I mean, I just did another film that now is in, you know, was in theaters, and it's a complete opposite. It's called Breaking Surface. It's a Swedish survival drama.
Oh, cool.
Two sisters go scuba diving. One gets hit by this big rock fall and gets pressed down to the ground, can't get out, is on the ocean floor, and the other sister has to get her out. And it's this one of those nail-biting survival dramas.
It just sounds
complete
tense.
Opposite. Yes. Yeah. The opposite, like, and that's also beautiful. I'm going from a kissing booth film to the really, like, 180 to tension devices, sound design, manipulation, you know, recorded fortissimo brass, and then filtered it and be creative with that.
Yeah.
That's, you know, if you're pigeonholed and you're only doing comedy, I think that would not be good for me either. I wouldn't like it.
No, of course. And funnily enough, after our conversation earlier, it's almost horror, right? It's basically going from comedy to horror.
Exactly right. But it's also drama. For me, my heart, you know, is all for the drama aspect of it. If there's horror elements in it, sure. But I like to see them as an emotional intensity, a part of drama. Not too much genre thinking here. This is that cliche of horror that I need to serve here. Then it's really fun. I think, you know, any independent film that's in that in that realm of dealing with tension, or intense tension, but from a drama perspective, not from a specifically horror perspective. For me, the movie Get Out, for example, is, yeah, maybe it's a horror film, but I think it's a drama, you know, like...
Yeah, see, I kind of agree with the way that it's kind of treated.
Right? And that's, to me, that's fun. I mean, there's a lot of horror technique in the score, and I like the score, but it's almost like this dark... It's a dark comedy, has dark comedy almost elements in it, you know? Like, if you feel it's like it's this, you know, like... like taking this racism to the absurd, and I think that also made this film very special. I'm always looking for films that have something special and different to tell. That's also beautiful, to be in this whole industry where there's so many new things and people have to come up with new intelligent scripts. You know, it's not always successful, as we all know.
Yeah.
But there is great film out there, and that's what I'm always looking for.
Yeah, and I think it's a fascinating balance to try and find, to be honest.
Yep. It's a good, and for me, the balance also comes from teaching it also at USC. You know, I've been teaching there 14 years now as a professor.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's the same program that I took, you know, in 2002.
That must be so cool.
It's great. It's really great. I learn so much from these students. I learn about this new generation, you know, like how they think about film music, media music, music for games.
Yeah.
That's another complete cool field. And I still believe that these traditional values that I'm teaching them are also, it's fundamental to, and I think... very important to know and very important to understand and to listen to a Beethoven symphony, even if you never write like that, but to understand why it's so special and getting these deeper values of music and not just focusing on film music. Hey, I want to be the next Hans Zimmer. You know, like that to me is a bit too shallow. I rather
yeah.
would love for them to expand the horizon, you know, in music terms. I've studied so much, as you know. I've studied,
yes.
Like so many, many, many decades, gazillion years. And I'd like to just share my point of view, very specific, very maybe opinionated point of view of music, of the beauty of things that, of these values and deep values in music. And there's a humanitarian quality to me in music that is so appealing and that I that's why I still love to listen to a Mozart piece or a Beethoven piece or a Vivaldi symphony. And it's,
yeah.
Or this wonderful jazz piece or Keith Jarrett or Brett Meldow or like, you know, like, it doesn't really matter what kind of it is, but to be in that universe, you know, be in this beautiful, colorful, beautiful universe of music. And that's, and it's not, shouldn't be just film music focused so much. I mean, I'm sure we all teach film composition and dramaturgy and all that, but music first really has always been my mantra. Teaching and still for also for myself, music first, you know, film music is second, you know, like it's music with music. I mean, the values that music can give, to me as a human being and what music can teach me as a human being. And I think that's, it becomes now a little philosophical here, but I truly believe in that.
No, I agree though, because the music is the kind of ether that we draw from to make film music, if that makes sense. Like music is such a bigger concept.
So true. Exactly right. You know, music for film is pretty much also, it's a commercial endeavor also, as we talked, right?
Yeah.
It's there is a monetary aspect of it, even if you want to ignore it, but it is there. It is a, it belongs to the entertainment
yeah.
industry. And I think that's, you know, needs to also be said. And but it's still, it can be super fun and very artistically, for me also artistically fulfilling, even though it's commercial. But it's it doesn't really matter. I can still contribute to some greater vision of a project and follow somebody else's vision, like a director's vision. You know, like I find that it's still liberating to me. It's not. I always like get this question, isn't that too limiting, you know, when you're just writing music to a film that's already been done, kind of, you know, like, and you're just, you know, enhancing it and adding to it. And I feel because of the limitation, it can still give you, you know, an artistic liberty that you still, I mean, like some films more so than others. But overall, I think you have the chance to create something very special and very much something that is you and that represents you in this journey. And to me, writing an absolute piece of music, a symphony on its own, that to me is a much greater challenge, actually, because then I feel like I have too many choices.
Well, this is it, right? Limitations breed creativity.
Exactly. I mean, for some people, a symphony, you know, like absolute music, let's call it, absolute music for its own sake is much easier to write than being distracted by a film. And I understand where they're coming from, because they are coming from more of the musical mechanisms and not so much the dramaturgical mechanisms of film. And if once you've, you know, like, again, as I said, you know, you in film music, you become more and more of a dramaturgist, someone that understands drama, is a specialist in drama and story and characters, not so much in music for its own sake. You're becoming here to understand the code in music, what music can do dramaturgically, and understanding that. You're becoming an expert at understanding what music does to the drama, or what
yeah.
what drama is in a certain chord progression or in a certain groove or in a certain, you know, sound. So it's, yeah, it's a wildly fascinating thing, and I just that's why I still love doing this.
Yeah, and it's almost an endless discussion, really. I could literally talk about composition and sound design and everything for absolutely ages.
Same here.
So sadly, I could talk about this forever, but I'm drawing towards my final couple of questions. So first of all, I just want to ask, what else are you working on that you can tell us about?
So I will be, you know, I'm in Germany right now for another couple weeks, and I will be flying back to LA because duty is calling here. I will be starting on The Kissing Booth Part 3, believe it or not, another sequel, and that will complete this trilogy, at least for now. I don't know if there's anything else planned, but this is it, to bring the story to a beautiful end. And I know already that it's going to be emotional and beautiful, and everything that the fans are looking for.
Awesome.
And other than that, I will be diving into a documentary. I did finish one that was about, you know, like racial injustice in a little town in Georgia. Interestingly enough, it's very timely right now.
I was going to say, yeah. Still waiting on Georgia.
yes, yes. Unbelievable close how this is. I can't believe how close this is.
I know, it's nail-biting.
Hi, yeah, yeah. And this other documentary that is about five camera women that tell their story, how, you know, how they were, you know, working on documenting all these wars and all these crisis areas around the world in the 80s and 90s, and how they had to deal with, you know, for example, crisis in the Middle East and in Iraq and the Arab Spring, and all these things are documented, and it's very fascinating footage. And these are all camera women, and that was, I guess, a normal thing to employ women for the job. And these very strong women, awesome women, are telling their story. It's going to be probably on CNN, I believe, and this will be a project that will be next, plus finishing, hopefully, my book on this.
Oh, fantastic.
Matter of film music composition. Everyone's always been bugging me, and I've been bugging myself. I was like, when do you freaking get this done? So it's 400 pages and right now, and I still have to edit it a little bit, but I have my hopes that this will get done after the Kissing Booth 3.
Oh, fingers crossed.
And these are the projects ahead of me.
That's amazing. And I have a fun question to finish off with before I let you go today. And that is, if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Of course, we talked about the patience factor, right? That
yes.
is very important. Patience,
endurance. Yeah, you get that as a freebie. That, you know, we've yeah. already covered that one.
tenacity, and all these things. The one piece of advice I would probably always give is, and since I also made that mistake, is don't wait to be discovered. That is a very important piece of advice, and that means don't sit in your bubble and just hope that some producer is going to knock on your studio door because he or she heard your music, you know, through the door and was just swinging by and heard, hey, that's cool music. I think I should knock on that person's door.
Yeah.
That is just so unlikely.
It's never going to happen, really.
exactly. I just, you know, and so it is really important, I guess, for, as we talked about this jungle, to gain visibility. And visibility in this jungle means posting, unfortunately, all this social media stuff, but also anything that you can, any article, news article, a blog, for example, anything that you, that creates traction and followers. And this is the world we live in, right? This is what you need to do. And, you know, like, unless you are this absolutely cool band and you have this, you know, absolutely unique sound and you have all these fan followers and you feel like, hey, I want to be in film, and or maybe a director finds your sound of your band so extremely cool and different that, you know, that you will be asked, like Trent Reznor, for example, you know, Nine Inch Nails, for example, you know, like, yes. It's on top of it. It's so cinematic and it's really cool. And I can totally see this work in film. So like, absolutely. And his fan base was already through the roof before even doing film. So, but again, looking at the normality of people, normal human beings, we need to make sure that we post and promote the work after it's done. You get something, even as a short film, you promote if it got into a film festival. You reach out to people with these promotions. You participate in competitions. You get your name out. You cannot wait to be discovered. It is you will be only frustrated and sitting in your own little bubble. So do that and start and try to your mind to always, I always say this also to my students, start collecting these little tokens of mini success stories.
Yeah.
So whenever you have a tiny little mini success story, this short film got into this festival, collect it as something good. It's a little thing that happened that was good that came your way. You got a little award, you got a nomination for something. Here for me, The Kissing Booth got, well, that's a pretty big token, but again, it got nominated for Best Comedy. That's a huge token for me as a big success story. But so even a mini success story could mean, hey, you struggled so much with this cue that you were writing, you're working on, and at the end of the day, you were able to nail those four bars that you were struggling with all day long.
Yeah.
That's a mini success story in creative terms. So collect these mini success stories as if they were little tokens. And so to get into a positive mindset about this, because I know many of you out there are probably on the sensitive side, or maybe introverts, or maybe, you know, like myself, actually, I'm very introvert, to gain this confidence with these mini success stories, so that you're looking, now the glass is half full and not empty. And with that, put out good energy, put your work out, gain visibility, do not wait to be discovered.
And I think that's a fantastic piece of advice and a fantastic place to end this.
Absolutely.
It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, Patrick, and I hope you'll join us again soon at least.
Please, anytime. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Well, we wish you all the best with Kissing Booth 3, your book, and everything else that's coming our way.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Hey everyone, this is Sam. Thanks very much for listening to the Sound Architect podcast today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If so, there are many ways you can support the show, which is incredibly appreciated. Obviously, there's the financial way where you can support us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/sounddesignuk. However, there are many other ways which also help, such as liking, subscribing, reviewing, commenting, and sharing via whatever channel you listen on. Even a like or share on social media really, really helps. So thanks so much for your support already. It really is a work of passion for me, and I'd love to keep sharing the knowledge from all these talented and wonderful people. Thanks again, and catch you on the next episode.
Hey, everybody. This is Tim from Tonebenders. We have a new episode out featuring an extended interview with legendary production sound mixer John Pritchett. John has worked on projects from Dirty Dancing to Avengers Endgame and just about everything in between. He has seen it all and has the stories to prove it. To take a listen, head over to ToneMendersPodcast.com or search ToneMenders through your podcast app.
Hey, this is Christian from a Sound Effect Podcast. In our latest episode, you will hear about designing sound for Netflix series The Crown and composing music for The Haunting of Bly Manor. Check it out at soundeffect.com/podcast.